that's the Russian national anthem. Introduce us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we want to be talking about Russia today, which is, of course, really burst onto the news a couple of days ago, about a week ago, with Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And that has unleashed significant sanctions from numerous countries worldwide. And to discuss the effects of these sanctions on Russia and the wider world, we want to talk with David P. Goldman, a man I like to call a Renaissance thinker, who is the person behind the internationally renowned Spengler column at the Asia Times, where he's also an editor, and is the author most recently of the book You Will Be Assimilated: China's Plan to Sinoform the World. Well, David, thank you for joining the show.
Andrew, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Well, looking at these sanctions starting out, I guess, you know, one big thing that's come down is we've had these this de-swifting, as it's called, of Russia from the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT, a Brussels-based organization. What exactly is this organization? Who controls it? And what does this mean for Russia?
SWIFT is the messaging service which all the world's banks use for international transactions. So if you buy a porcelain dish from China, some bank in China is going to get a remittance from a bank in the United States, ultimately, for a shipment of porcelain dishes. Trade can't go on without it, except that China and Russia now have alternatives. Now, the U.S. dollar, Andrew, is the world's international reserve currency, at least the most important one. Now, what that means is that the world's public and private banks hold their reserves, their cash balances, overwhelmingly in U.S. dollars. That's $8 trillion of U.S. Treasury securities held by foreign central banks, and about $16 trillion in offshore bank accounts held by foreigners. So those are the equivalent of about $25 trillion of low-interest loans to the United States of America. Given that we import a great deal more than we export, we give people our paper, they give us their goods, that's extremely important to us. And what's been raised as a result of these sanctions is the possibility that the world will find other means via Russian and Chinese platforms to finance international trade and leave the American-dominated system. And that's not going to happen overnight, but it's raised that prospect, and that could be very bad for us.
Okay, so with having the dollar as a leading reserve currency, along with maybe, say, like, you know, the euro, or, you know, I don't know, Japanese yen, or, but certainly the predominant one being the dollar, means that, you know, dollars are in high demand. People want dollars in order to conduct transactions, so they're going to always want to get your dollars. So they're investing in your banks, they're taking out loans from your banks and so forth. So you always have then easy capital, because everyone wants to have these dollar denominated accounts or loans.
Oh, exactly. The fact that the world keeps their transaction balances in dollars is the equivalent, as I said, of a $25 trillion loan to the United States. That's more than a year of our gross domestic product. It's a great deal of money. Now, we've kicked most of the Russian banks out of the SWIFT system. We've made it impossible for them to conduct international trade on the dollar system. But China has something called the Cross-Border International Payment System, or CIPS. It's much smaller. It only really involves Chinese transactions, and it conducts business in the Chinese currency, the RMB. The Russians also have an international payment system. It's hardly been used because nobody wants rubles. Now, there's a very good reason for people to want to keep their balances in dollars as opposed to, say, Chinese RMB. There are exchange controls in China. You've got to get permission to move money inside and outside the country. That can be done, but it's cumbersome, and no one knows when it might be subject to change. The American dollar can be traded anywhere. You can have the transaction balance. You can use it to buy Tesla stock or use it to buy treasury bills. Do whatever you want with it. So a free currency like the dollar has advantages. But if you push people out of the system, you put a gun to their head and say, we're going to seize your money if you violate our sanctions, you may very well push people into using the Chinese platform, particularly the Russians. And the Russians provide about a tenth of the world's hydrocarbons. So they're not an insubstantial trader. And many people, including the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, Ken Rogoff, have warned that this could be the beginning of the end of dollar dominance. Now, I don't want to panic anyone. You don't want to run out and take, put your dollars in a tin can and bury them in your garden just now. But we are pushing our power to the limits. And the Chinese, for the first time, offer a credible alternative. And that is a dangerous moment for us. It could be a bridge loan too far, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And in SWIFT, who controls this organization? I mean, does America have sole influence over it, or does it have to cooperate with other countries?
SWIFT is an organization owned by the banks who participate in it. It is a private organization. However, the United States, which controls dollar flows, can sanction banks that it doesn't like. SWIFT is only a messaging service. So if, as I said, you buy a porcelain dish from China, your bank, say, J.P. Morgan Chase, will send a payment to a Chinese bank, say the Agricultural Bank of China. The message that securely orders that transaction goes through SWIFT, but the actual payment goes through the bank. So as long as banks are operating in U.S. dollars, the United States can seize their accounts, because ultimately a dollar account offshore is dependent on a book entry at a bank in the United States, and the U.S. Treasury ultimately has control over that. That's not true of Chinese banks trading in RMB. That's outside our ability to interfere with. Now, there's been a huge amount of discussion about Russia moving towards the Chinese payment system, given the fact that they've been effectively shut out of a large part of the financial system. China is reluctant to open the floodgates there because China perceives that if Chinese banks start helping Russia to avoid sanctions in an obvious and aggressive way, that might bring down sanctions on Chinese banks who also are doing business in U.S. dollars. Really, the most radical thing that's happened in all of this is not just that Russian banks have been kicked out of the SWIFT system. Much more important is that most of Russia's foreign exchange reserves have been frozen by the United States, Europe, and Japan. They still have $630 billion of reserves. Most of those are not accessible to them. They do have about $80 billion of reserves in China, and those are accessible. Now, at the point where foreign governments can take your money away, they can expropriate you, kind of like Canadian citizens found when the Canadian government seized their bank accounts if they'd made contributions to the truckers' protest. If other countries can be subject to that kind of regime, they may be a lot more reluctant to keep money in U.S. dollars in the future. Now, China alone is $3 trillion, 3.2
actually.
Yeah,
and indeed, this is the first time then that the
Hello? I've lost the line. Hello? Hello? I'm sorry, I've lost the line. If you could hear me, I'm going to dial back in. Andrew, hello.
Yes, this is the first time that such foreign currency reserves of a country have been seized, I believe, in terms of sanctions, correct?
Iranian reserves were seized. So it's not the first time, but Iran is a very small economy. Russia is one of the top 10 economies in the world. So there's never been a seizure on this scale or a seizure of reserves of a country that's a world military power. So it does break a lot of glass. And again, as Kenneth Rogoff, former chief economist of IMF, said at a Yahoo interview a few days ago, this puts us into an entirely new and dangerous kind of world.
Now, so far, there's only been a delisting of 7 major banks under SWIFT. Do you think SWIFT will do more, and should they do more delisting of Russian banks?
Well, these sanctions are always a double-edged sword. The world is short of energy. Russia is selling energy. There is a net deficit of supply. That's why oil prices were going up pretty steadily even before the Ukraine invasion occurred. And now, you know, the price of oil is above $110 a barrel, and we're seeing gas at the pump at above $5 in some American cities. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, to what extent are we shooting ourselves in the foot by cutting Russian oil out of markets? Right now, there's enormous uncertainty. A lot of Russian oil is going unsold because people are afraid to buy it. They're afraid to transfer dollars to Russia, even if sanctions haven't applied yet, because they're afraid they might come under the gun of regulators. And as long as no one knows what's going on, we're going to have a very disorderly energy market, and prices at the pump will continue to go up. I don't think that any amount of sanctions are going to stop the Russians from doing what they're doing in Ukraine. You play the Russian national anthem at the beginning of the show. I think that was an appropriate starting point, because there is a surge in patriotic support for Vladimir Putin in Russia right now. The polls, the last polls that came out show 68% approval versus 22% disapproval for the Russian incursion into Ukraine. And the Russians, who've had their own historical experience with defending the motherland against foreign threats, see this not as an attack on Putin, but as an attack on Russia. So it will take a lot more and maybe a very long time to discourage the Russians. So there's a bigger question as to whether sanctions are effective to begin with.
Yeah, indeed, and that deals then with the delisting of more banks from SWIFT. That would then involve, as you indicate, to touch upon buying energy from Russia, and Russia is such a key energy source. Well, could Western countries actually then boycott Russian energy sales? What would that entail, or is that something, a step that the West could take?
Well, of course we could. We'd have to suffer much higher energy prices and probably some shortages. And in the case of Europe, the big issue is natural gas. Natural gas price in Europe for the most of the last 10, 15 years was in the $20 to $30 range. Now it's about $180. So the effect of that in European economies will be substantial. But if we're willing to take a major hit to our economies and a huge increase in the price of energy, we could do whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
well, in that
the Russians
regard,
can also sell.
You know, like,
yes.
It sounds like, you know, comparing, like, maybe, of course, you know, to the oil embargoes of the 1970s, you know, in 73 and so forth from OPEC. But then I guess that brings up the issue. Could we get OPEC, like Saudi Arabia and other countries, to step in with increased production to alleviate such shortages?
They could almost certainly alleviate some part of it, but certainly not all of it. So there's a question as to how much additional they can pump. I've heard a lot of speculation about what the ability to stretch capacity might be in the Persian Gulf, but I really can't tell you exact numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, but indeed you're saying, you know, Russia is about a source for 10% of the fossil fuels of the world, so that is indeed a significant shortfall if you take that out. Do you think Russia, you know, hearing of these sanctions, you know, there's been a lot of talk of, like, runs on the bank in Russia and so forth, and you talked about the reserve situation. Will Russia react in coming days with any sort of financial controls?
Russia has already imposed financial controls. It's already prevented foreigners from taking money out of Russia. But that's a relatively minor thing. Remember that Russia is one of the world's biggest wheat exporters. I think at the moment it is actually the biggest wheat exporter. If Russia cannot sell wheat overseas, then you may have serious hunger in countries like Egypt and Turkey, for example, which are major importers of wheat from Russia. It's certainly possible for the world wheat market to be reorganized in a way that allows Russia, say, to sell to China instead of buying China buying wheat from Ukraine. Egypt can buy wheat from Ukraine, but since a lot of that wheat goes to the Black Sea and the Black Sea ports are closed, you may have serious problems with hunger in a number of countries which are major Russian wheat importers. But Russia itself has all the food and all the energy it needs. We've also put a boycott on export of, for example, computer chips to Russia. Computer chips are the building block of every modern economy. China, however, can supply Russia with all the chips it needs. It can do so overland. There's no way of preventing it from happening and no way of even knowing that it's happening. So I don't think the Russian economy can be destroyed by any of these sanctions. It will be hurt. The Russian economy might shrink 15% over the next year, but it will still function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there have been other technological sanctions I've heard of, like, you know, semiconductor chips, as well as, you know, airplane companies have ceased giving spare parts and so forth for the Russian airlines. So there are certain sectors there that you can try to hit at Russia. But as, I guess as you indicate, with semiconductor chips and others, you know, China can always step in and fill all those gaps.
For most of the tech products, China can certainly fill the gaps. And China, you know, is in the catbird seat here because it can go to the West and say, we want to be reasonable, we're willing to mediate, we're telling the Russians to seek a peaceful solution. We deplore all of these things. China, of course, abstained in a vote to condemn Russia at the United Nations Security Council, didn't vote against it or for it. But at the same time, reading websites in China and talking to Chinese policy analysts close to the government, their view is because of these Western sanctions, there's only one direction that Vladimir Putin can go, and that's east. So the sanctions have kind of pushed Russia into China's lap, and China can take its own sweet time about exploiting that. But there's no backing out.
Mm-hmm. And what about, you know, we talked about, you know, seizing the foreign currency reserves of the Russian government. What about as well, you know, now there are moves to, you know, seize the assets of various allies of Vladimir Putin or leaders in the Russian government, you know, these oligarchs and so forth that you've had, you know, yacht seizures in Germany and France and so forth. What effect will that have?
Well, Putin certainly, his power base certainly includes some of the so-called oligarchs. That could, at the margin, give him a certain amount of political headache, but I think most of that is mainly symbolic. Russia is a great power. It's not going to be brought down by sanctions. Sanctions have never stopped a country from doing what it wants to do when it feels it has an existential strategic interest at stake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And I mean, we talk about all these issues. You know, these, as you say, this is, sanctions are a double-edged sword. I mean, we've got oil, energy, natural gas, and then, you know, also wheat is a big factor here. And then the whole issue of with the currency markets of, you know, you damage the reliability, the leading role of the dollar. So this is a real tricky game, I guess. Yeah, I can't think of any example of sanctions stopping a country. I mean, we've had, for example, sanctions on Iran. I mean, what has that done in terms of nuclear proliferation?
No, that didn't work with Iran, which is a much weaker economy than Russia. And if you're sitting in Beijing now, watching all these things happen, Chinese have 3.2 $2 trillion of reserves. Most of them are in U.S. dollars. $2 trillion alone are in U.S. Treasury securities. And the Chinese are thinking, suppose we get into a dust-up with the United States over Taiwan or something else. Are they going to seize our reserves? So what I expect the Chinese to do, and it will take a while because it's not easy, is to convert as much of their dollar reserves as they can into hard goods. Gold, lithium, palladium, platinum, copper, oil, whatever they can get their hands on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. And, go ahead.
Well, I think that's going to give a boost to commodity prices, which will continue for a while and contribute significantly to inflation in the United States. That's not a good thing when people lose confidence in currency and want to own hard goods instead. That's the definition of an inflationary spiral. That's the kind of thing which really produces long-term sustained and high inflation, which, of course, is a burden on the vast majority of people who've got no way to protect themselves against that kind of inflation. But when you go around seizing the reserves of central banks, you tell a sovereign government you have this money parked in a bank or with the U.S. government, and you don't own it anymore. We've just taken it because we don't like what you're doing militarily. Then other people will take the hint and move their reserves out of dollars as well. So, again, the seizure of assets on this scale, seizing assets isn't unprecedented, but it is unprecedented on this scale. That's a very dangerous thing for the United States and Europe to do, and the blowback could be substantial.
Mm-hmm. And would there be any cost to China doing that, getting its gold bug on or such, palladium or other silver or other resources, shifting out of the dollar? Could they just as well, say, sell gold to finance whatever they want to do?
The Chinese don't have enough gold. Right now, about 5% of their reserves, it's about $150 billion, are in gold. That's against $3.2 trillion of total reserves. They're probably kicking themselves they didn't buy more in the past. Russia's been transferring reserves into gold for quite some time. There isn't a lot of gold to go around. All the gold mined since the beginning of time is now worth about $17 trillion, according to the World Gold Council. And a lot of that is stuck away in places who will never sell it. Central bank reserves are only about $2.3 trillion. That's not even enough to substitute for all of China's reserves. So if you want to substitute the dollar for gold, well, the gold price is going to have to go up a great deal. That could be one consequence. Personally, I own some gold in my portfolio. I think everybody should.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying take out a mortgage in your house and buy gold or anything, but it's good to own some.
Yeah, right. Especially if the Chinese are going to be buying, it's going to become more valuable. Well, if we talk about pushing the Chinese towards the Russians, what would sort of like an alliance like that or relationship like that look like, or what effects might that have?
Well, it would have important effects, Andrew, and none of them would be good for us. Let's start with science and technology. The biggest scarce resource in the world today is not oil or lithium or anything like that. It's highly trained engineers. Russia is like some character from the monster movie with a gigantic head and a tiny little body. Its economy is the size of Italy, but its scientific and engineering establishment is the size of the United States. Russia has roughly as many engineers as the U.S. does. In the United States, I think 7% of college undergraduates major in engineering. In Russia, it's 35%. And although Russian industry, except for a few pockets of excellence in the defense sector, really mediocre, Russian engineering and science is excellent. If you put Russia's human capital, its vast resources of science and engineering, at the disposal of China, that vastly strengthens China's position. And China has been all over that trade for a while. For example, Huawei, the telecommunications company that about which there was so much hubbub in the last several years, has its biggest research facilities outside of China in Russia. There's five major research installations. It's training 50,000 engineers in Russia. It's a huge commitment. They've canceled all of their R&D in the United States and Australia and some other countries because they've been under political pressure, and they've moved it to Russia, where the engineers are very well educated and, of course, a lot cheaper to hire than they are in the United States. So you already see a convergence of high-tech industry between Russia and China. Russia needs a semiconductor industry. It's going to merge its semiconductor industry with China's. And that gives China a world where high tech is the key to economic strength as well as military power. That gives China a huge advantage. I could give you a couple of other examples of where China benefits. China's the world's biggest energy importer. Most of its oil comes now from the Persian Gulf. That's a vulnerability in the case of some kind of hostilities between the U.S. and China. The U.S. Navy could interdict tankers coming from the Persian Gulf before they got to China. So China wants to increase the amount of energy that it gets overland via pipeline, and the Russians will be more than happy to sell more of their energy to China now that they can't sell all of their energy overseas. Europe or the U.S., though they're still selling some, that's under threat, they'll be much more inclined to build pipelines to sell it to China, and they'll probably give the Chinese a very good price on it.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. If you think of such a relationship between Russia and China, is that going to happen anyway? Is that just sort of a natural thing? I mean, you have these two countries that, you know, are anti-Western, anti-U.S., and have their own various goals. Is it sort of natural for them to just come together anyway?
I don't think there's anything natural about it, Andrew. As Vladimir Putin said in the speech he gave just before invading Ukraine, he had asked Bill Clinton in 1990 for Russia to be able to join NATO. Putin has always wanted Russia to orient towards the West, but with certain limitations. The one tripwire for Russia, which has been there forever, and every responsible diplomat involved in this has reported it, including William Burns, the current CIA director. Russia will not tolerate NATO going up to its border. And the real issue for Russia has been Ukraine joining NATO. Putin asked for an assurance that Ukraine wouldn't join NATO. We wouldn't give it. That's the origin of the present crisis. When the Berlin Wall came down and Germany was reunified, the West gave Russia assurances that NATO wouldn't expand to the East. We tore those up afterwards because Russia was in a state of collapse, and we figured Russia didn't have any ability to complain. They were too beaten down. But now Russia's not that beaten down, and it's drawn a line there. So I think there was an opportunity to draw Russia closer to the West, away from China. The Russians are Europeans. They have much more in common with us. It's a Christian country, much more culturally in common with the West than they do with China, and much more advantages in being economically hooked up to the West than to China. So I think we really pushed Putin into the arms of the Chinese and made a terrible mistake, which may haunt us for a very long time to come. The last thing we want is a Russian-Chinese axis opposing NATO.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking of NATO expansion, how would you then compare, you know, the issue of Ukraine with, of course, you know, to the north, the Baltics then came into NATO in 2004. Do you see, would Putin want to try to push NATO out of the Baltics?
Well, the Baltics are much less of a threat. If you look at a map, you have this enormous Russian territory sitting in the middle of that. That's Kaliningrad, which used to be the German city of Königsberg. That was Immanuel Kant's city. It was a Prussian city for centuries. The Russians took it after World War II, and that's one of their largest military bases, and it sits in the middle of the Baltic states. The corridor that NATO might use to resupply the Baltic states is tiny. It goes through Poland. Next to it, you've got this big bulge of Belarus. So from the Russian standpoint, the Baltic states are indefensible. They're this little outpost of NATO with a very small population that they could squash any moment they want. Ukraine, on the other hand, the Ukrainian border is a few minutes missile flight time from major Russian cities, including Moscow, as Putin pointed out. Ukraine is also a much larger country and with a huge border with Russia, and it also has a very large Russian-speaking minority. So the Russians, for a number of reasons, did not draw the line at the Baltic states, although they didn't particularly like the Baltic states joining NATO. They drew the line at Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you speak of there of the old East Prussia, Ostpreussen on Königsberg, now the Kaliningrad Oblast that Russia got after World War II when East Prussia was divided between Poland and Russia, and then Belarus, you know, which is basically sort of almost annexed to Russia, a satellite of Russia. You know, those two almost close off access from Poland into the Baltic states, only a narrow gap there. What about, like, say, Finland, thinking further afield? What if Finland were to join NATO? What, any sort of particular problem there?
That's an interesting question. Finland, of course, has been neutral from you know, for its entire national existence. There, it's conceivable Finland might join NATO. The Finns have a very good army, and they're good fighters. When the Russians invaded Finland, I believe in 1940, they eventually won out of overwhelming force, but they had a horrible experience there. They don't want to do it again. And, of course, Sweden has been talking about joining NATO. So that's a concern for the Russians. I don't know if Russia can or would do anything about Finland joining. Ukraine is a special case because you have a large Russian-speaking population, and a likely outcome is that the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk on the Russian border, will either be puppet republics recognized by Russia and controlled by Russia or actually absorbed by Russia. That will basically transfer all of Ukrainian industry, including the arms industry, to Russia. What will be left is the agricultural portion of Ukraine, western Ukraine, which is good agricultural land, but not really economically viable by itself.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. You were just saying not economically viable by itself with Ukraine.
Yes. And that would leave Ukraine as a rump. Remember, Ukraine is a failed state. It's literally a failed state in the sense that before the Russian invasion, almost half of the working age population had already left the country. So on paper, according to its census, Ukraine has 45 million people, but the Demographics Institute of the Ukrainian National Academy of Sciences says it's only 33 million because so many people have emigrated. It's a bit of a shell. Now, a million additional Ukrainians have emigrated since the war began. I think it's very likely that much larger numbers will emigrate, and the result will be a hollowed-out country without much going for it, and a permanent sore in Europe, a permanent split which will not be resolved diplomatically for a very long time. The Russians will sit on the eastern part. There will be Kiev will be kind of a no-man's land, and Ukraine will be depopulated.
I see. So, yeah, you think, as sort of indicated by the movements of Russian troops, that, the Russians would sort of stay in the eastern part, precisely in the sort of Russian-dominated zone, and just sort of leave the west. There's not much to interest the Russians in the western part. And do you know the Russian-speaking population of Ukraine, how do they feel about this Russian incursion or about allegiance to Russia? I mean, are they really anxious to, sort of return to Mother Russia or such and be under Russian control again?
It's hard to know exactly how they feel because it's difficult to get real information out of there, but my own sources tell me that the Ukrainian Russian speakers are not at all happy about the Russian army invasion. There is a core which has been pro-Russian and under Russian control really since 2014, since you had the breakaway rebellions in Donetsk and Luhansk. But for the most part, the Russian speakers would rather be left alone and live their own lives. So I don't think Putin's a terribly popular guy right now, even among Russian speakers in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, then, thinking of all this confrontation with Russia and the West again, and Russia then possibly moving closer to China, what would be the disadvantages for Russia? People have often talked about, there have been conflicts between Russia and China, and Russia should, watch out if it subordinates itself to China. Thinking about, Russia might want to go into China might want to sort of move into the Russian Far East, and would this be like comparable to Germany and Italy during World War II, that Germany's the dominant partner and it ultimately sort of controls Italy, or China would really dominate Russia?
Well, I think China, without any question, would be the senior partner. That entails a number of really annoying disadvantages from the Russian standpoint. I do not believe the Chinese would want to seize large parts of Siberia. China has an aging and eventually diminishing population. They simply don't have the people to resettle in a hostile and forbidding and miserable part of the world. Why should Chinese want to go live in Siberia? It's not as if they have a huge population surplus which needs to move somewhere. On the contrary, they have a declining population. So the prospect of China seizing Siberia seems unrealistic given the demographics. Nonetheless, there are many ways in which having China as a senior partner can be a really unpleasant experience. Ask the Iranians what it's like to depend on China for your trade. The Chinese will sell you their goods at inflated prices. They'll underpay you for your goods. Russia would be much better off selling energy to the West at market prices. If they have to sell to the Chinese under contract prices, they'll be selling at a substantial discount. The Chinese drive a very hard bargain, leave no money on the table. Sometimes they don't even leave the table.
Interesting. I think historically the Chinese often complain that, the Russians exploited them in the past, like under the Soviet Union after World War II when Mao signed various treaties with the Soviet Union. But I guess you're saying now, the Chinese could really sort of get their revenge back on the Russians, could really exploit them and drive a hard bargain there.
It goes way before the problems between Khrushchev and Mao after World War II. The Russians were part of the eight-nation alliance that suppressed the Boxer Rebellion and carved out concessions out of Chinese territory in 1900. The Chinese have not forgotten about that one either.
Right, of course. I mean, Port Arthur and so forth, where then the Japanese attacked at the beginning of the Russo-Japanese War. I guess they're called treaties of humiliation or so forth among the various powers, Britain and Germany and France and Russia imposed at various times.
Absolutely. The Chinese have a long memory, and they are soreheads about these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, looking at the United States and its allies, you know, we talked about oil. You know, people have noticed this hypocrisy. Like, we're still taking in all this oil from Russia, even amidst all these sanctions, because, as you say, you know, we really need it. You know, what should the United States and other countries do to try to reduce that dependence in the future? I mean, we have this controversy here in the United States of, like, Keystone Pipeline, Biden shut down. And then, of course, also recently before this, the United States said no to supporting this Eastern Mediterranean pipeline from areas around Cyprus that would bring in natural gas into Europe. You know, what's going on there?
Well, if there ever has been a stupid, destructive, and self-defeating policy, if any country ever shot itself in both feet, it's the Biden administration discouraging oil and gas drilling in the continental United States. There is a huge amount of oil and gas available. We have, on stupid, spurious environmental grounds, discouraged it. Biden, of course, shut down the Keystone Pipeline, which would have been a substantial contributor. We should be going all out to develop domestic energy resources, which we have. The pipeline from Israel through the Eastern Mediterranean to Western Europe would cover, you know, probably about 5%, if I remember correctly, but a very small percentage of Europe's gas needs. But every little bit helps. Europe right now is not sure if it can do without Russian gas. If the weather is particularly cold, its reserves will be exhausted. They'll have to buy Russian gas anytime they can, which means effectively loosening the sanctions regime. So 5% may not sound like a lot, but the pipeline from Israel could make a substantial difference.
Yeah, and that's it's really nuts, you know, that the Biden administration is shutting down these alternative fossil fuel sources, all in the name of, you know, climate change, green energy, and I guess you know, people have noted that, you know, Russia itself has invested apparently in a lot of groups pushing this agenda, so playing kind of a political influence operation there. I wonder if China could do anything similar.
Look, the one thing China has done execrably is to try to develop political influence. Chinese propaganda and public relations have got to be the single worst product of the human mind since the dawn of man, since we split from the Neanderthals. Everybody hates the Chinese. They act like bullies. They play their cards badly. They sound arrogant. And they irk, they rub everybody the wrong way. The reason the Chinese have so much power is because they produce stuff that everybody needs. Chinese exports have been booming. Since the beginning of the COVID pandemic, for example, Chinese exports to the United States are up well over 30%, and even more to Germany. As we've threw money into the economy, into the industrial economies, Western economies, to compensate for the COVID effect, we found our supply chains simply were not robust enough to meet the demand, so we ended up importing huge amounts from China. And China is also importing huge amounts from the rest of Asia, including Taiwan, because industry in Asia is very integrated. The Taiwanese will sell parts to the Chinese, who will assemble them into an iPhone and sell it to the United States in turn. So China has huge economic influence, but its political influence has been very poor, much out of proportion to its economic power, partly because of their own arrogance and obnoxious characters.
Well, thinking of lessons for the Ukraine crisis for China, what should we learn about this? As you've indicated before, we could be facing confrontations with China. You know, what should we learn economically from this Ukraine crisis and dealing with China? I mean, do we have to look at what measures should we take, or can we think of in the future, like, could we ever apply any sanctions to China in a similar crisis, say, over Taiwan?
Well, we could. But you'd have to look at what the impact would be on the United States economy. In the case of Russia, we push up the price of oil, which is like a tax on every family and every business in the United States. In the case of China, we're not importing energy, of course. We're importing a vast amount of industrial goods, more than $600 billion a year. That's a lot of industrial goods. That's equal to about a quarter of our manufacturing gross domestic product. There's almost nothing that we use in the United States which doesn't have Chinese components. And, of course, with electronics, we're overwhelmingly dependent on Chinese imports, computers, tablets, smartphones, everything to do with that. If we were to seriously sanction China, there's no question that there would be a serious recession in the United States economy. There might even be a serious depression. So I think the lesson is let's shore up our own supply chains and make ourselves less dependent so that we don't end up shooting ourselves in the foot. If we had not discouraged domestic oil and gas production, we wouldn't be worrying about importing oil from Russia. We're stuck with this problem because of our own stupidity. Same way the Germans are stuck with natural gas because they shut down their nuclear power production at home. I think we need to radically reinvent American manufacturing, move supply chains back to the United States, and make ourselves less vulnerable to some kind of disruptive imports from China, because right now we probably couldn't do it. Let me give you one number, Andrew, which really I found really shocking. As of last year, we now import more capital goods than we make for domestic consumption. Capital goods are the goods that make other goods: backhoes, machine tools, stamping presses, everything that makes other goods. We are so dependent on the import of capital goods that if we wanted to become independent and rebuild our industry, we would first have to increase our imports to buy the capital goods to make the stuff that would help make us independent in the future. It's not something we could do quickly because we've let our industrial capacity deteriorate so far. There's no time to start like now, and we should, but it will take us quite some time to reduce our dependence on China for manufactured goods by any significant margin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
I was going to say there are people running around saying, let's cut off China and stop importing and seal ourselves off. China is evil and wicked, and they gave us COVID-19 and so forth, so let's punish them. That is a nice sentiment, but it is impossible. The numbers are simply too big. We're simply too dependent. I was a decoupler before decoupling was cool, but to decouple from China is a multi-year and enormously expensive process.
Right. But I guess so, both in the case of Russia and then even more so China, you know, we're seeing that we have these really serious interlinkages that prohibit any sort of action against these countries because it harms us so much. So if we want to have sort of any political independence in the future, we're really going to have to dial that down and achieve more economic independence.
Well, that's exactly the point. I'm an old hawk, by which I mean, if you want peace, prepare for war. On the other hand, if you want war, be weak and act provocatively. And that's basically what we got ourselves into in Ukraine. We pushed very hard to get Ukraine into NATO, and we started sending them anti-tank missiles and sophisticated weapons. Russia has said for years that Ukraine's entry into NATO would be a tripwire. So finally, they went in. And now we're sitting there. We can't defend Ukraine militarily. It's simply not realistic. Russia eventually will win this. In other words, they'll effectively reduce the Ukrainian army to something ineffective. They'll lose politically because everyone hates them and doesn't want to do business with them. But in the case of China, if we think that we have a dust-up with China coming, we had better get our act together now and strengthen ourselves and reduce our dependence.
Mm-hmm. Right, I guess you could say, you know, maybe the Ukraine crisis is sort of similar to, like, you know, the Spanish Civil War as the sort of a crisis, a prelude to World War II, that, you know, if we're looking at a really major confrontation with China, then we're going to have to learn some lessons here from Ukraine and see how we can act better next time in a much greater competition.
Well, we have a serious problem. China is a larger economy than ours in terms of purchasing power parity. In other words, in U.S. dollar terms, China is still smaller than us. But if you fly into a Chinese city, the taxi ride to an airport costs $5 instead of $50. So money goes a lot farther. So in terms of real purchasing power, China is a bigger economy. China for the past 20 years has been massively building up its defenses around its coast. So it's built thousands of surface-to-ship missiles, which it claims can sink American aircraft carriers. There's a debate among military specialists, which I'm not one of, about whether that's the case or not, though I know some very sophisticated people who insist they can sink American aircraft carriers. That means that a lot of the armaments which we acquired over years for many trillions of dollars just aren't that effective anymore. In a high-tech kind of war, China might very well beat us in the Western Pacific. So when we talk about a confrontation with China, we should be very careful about what that means and getting into it. Again, if you want peace, prepare for war. We are unprepared for a war with China. The question is, what would trigger war with China? And the obvious answer that comes to mind in our word association test would be Taiwan. If Taiwan were to be attacked by China, that might lead to a war. If, for example, the Chinese sent troop carriers across the Taiwan Straits to invade Taiwan and airplanes from an American aircraft carrier attacked the troop transports, China might sink the carrier, put us on the brink of nuclear war. If we avoided nuclear war, even under those circumstances, we'd be in a miserable position in terms of military standing if we lost a carrier. So I think we should be extremely careful about avoiding scenarios which would get us into a war with China. The result could be a nuclear exchange, and that would be a war nobody could possibly win.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess thinking of nuclear exchanges, that brings up maybe one other interesting point. You know, Russia is now involved with us in Vienna with these negotiations with Iran to, you know, try to figure out a new Iran nuclear deal. I mean, doesn't that also undermine any sort of argument about sanctions or opposing Russia if we're sort of still dependent on Russia to try to negotiate with Iran as a diplomatic partner? I mean, how does Iran play into all of this?
You know, I first wrote about this in 2008. I wrote an essay under my old Spengler byline entitled "Americans Play Monopoly and Russians Play Chess." And I argued that we should seek a deal with Russia over Ukraine in return for Russia's help in containing Iran. Right now, Iran is effectively a Russian and Chinese ally. And having Russia and China building up Iran, buying its energy, supporting its armaments and so forth, is a way for Russia and China to weaken the West. Unfortunately, the Biden administration is so wishy-washy on this, acting so much against American interests, they'll basically go along with this. So we'll end up with a Russian-Chinese alliance with major tendrils going into the Middle East. with Iran as their major ally, which, of course, threatens our allies in the Gulf, threatens Israel, and so forth. How that will play out for Iran itself is complicated. The Chinese are not an adventurous where the Middle East is concerned. China gets most of its oil imports from the Middle East. Whatever it does, it will still need Middle East oil for many years to come. The worst thing that could happen to China right now would be a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which interrupted oil flows out of the Persian Gulf. So to the extent China has any influence, it will try to suppress that kind of conflict. Certainly they don't want Iran to attack Israel. Israel might retaliate with a nuclear strike on Iran, and that would be the end of a great deal of oil in the Persian Gulf. So it's not clear how that will play out, but whatever it is, it does mean a significant diminution of American influence and American flexibility and the ability of the United States to make strategic choices. So it's not good for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and indeed, in the Russian case, if they give, like, technological aid and arms and so forth to Iran, what does Russia get in return from Iran in that deal? I mean, I guess, as you're indicating, they have a political interest to have, you know, another anti-American actor. But what do the Iranians give the Russians?
You summed it up exactly. All Russia has is the capacity to deploy Iran as a spoiler to harass the United States. Russia's history with Iran is complicated. They've been having wars with Iran since the early 18th century. Russia has allowed Israel to attack Iranian allied positions, Hezbollah and similar, and some Iranian forces in Syria for years. The Russians stood back and let the Israeli Air Force have a more or less free hand in attacking Iran's forces in Syria. That's simply because the Russians have no particular interest in Iran becoming the dominant power there. They'd like to use Iran for their purposes, but they don't want to give the Iranians too much leash. Russia also has excellent relations with Israel. There are a million Russians in Israel. Before the crisis, if you were in the airport in Tel Aviv, you'd see 40 flights a day, direct flights, going from Israel to various places in Russia and the former Soviet Union. So those relations are very good, and Putin himself has had very good relations with the former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Russia's complicated. It will play all sides. It will maneuver. It'll deceive. But they do want to use Iran as a lever against the United States because their main problem now is, of course, the United States.
Mm-hmm. But I guess there's nothing. Is there anything in particular Iran can offer for, like, whatever technological or military aid Russia gives them in terms of just a commercial relationship, or is it just purely Russian aid?
Well, it's not Russian aid. It's Russian sales. So, for example, the Russians sold the obsolete version of their air defense system, the S-300. To Iran. They also sold a somewhat more advanced system, the S-400, to Turkey. Iran's a customer. But Russia has only secondary economic interests in Iran. There isn't a great deal Iran can do for Russia. This is really only a point of leverage against the United States.
All right, then. Excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been hearing another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to examine important events of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been talking to David P. Goldman, the Renaissance thinker, as I often call him, behind the renowned Asia Times Spengler column, and author most recently of You Will Be Assimilated, China's Plan to Sinoform the World. And we've been discussing the sanctions against Russia over its war in Ukraine and the wider implications for the world. Well, David Goldman, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Have a great weekend. Thanks to all your listeners.
Excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.